This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This year, NASA will begin the first official U.S. search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Science writer Timothy Ferris says, regardless of whether we find intelligent life out there, this search will encourage us to focus attention on what we mean by intelligence. At the same time that astronomers are searching the skies, neurologists are studying the human brain, revealing fascinating things about human intelligence. In the new book, The Mind's Sky, Human Intelligence in a Cosmic Context, Timothy Ferris examines questions that face us about intelligence in the outer and inner worlds. Ferris is the author of several books on astronomy and physics, including Coming of Age in the Milky Way, Galaxies, and The Red Limit. His writing has been recognized with awards from the American Institute of Physics and the American Association for the Advancement of Science. He teaches at the University of California at Berkeley. The search for extraterrestrial intelligence, known by the acronym SETI, is still considered pretty fringy by some Americans. I wondered why Ferris supports it.
The real reason, I think, is that if we don't listen, we'll never know. There are a lot of good arguments that one can make for the existence of life and perhaps intelligent life, whatever exactly that may mean, on other planets. And most of these arguments have to do with numbers. There are just so many stars and presumably planets out there that even if life or intelligence were a rare phenomenon, you'd still expect it to crop up. But whether or not these arguments are correct, the problem with taking the opposite point of view is that you end up not listening. And to me, SETI is more a matter of exploration than of science. And the rule in exploration is, you know, you got to go out and have a look around.
How much money are you willing to spend on it? You know, times are so hard economically.
Well, I would be willing to spend probably.
How much of your money, Timothy Ferris, are you willing to spend on this project?
Well, I would put up, a dollar a year, let's say. The NASA project actually will cost me only, and every other taxpayer, only about a nickel a year. So that seems reasonable enough.
Or is that really what it's costing us, 5 cents?
Yeah, it works out to around $10 million a year, and that works out to about a nickel per person.
Can you describe in a little bit more detail what NASA will be doing when it starts the SETI project later this year?
The NASA will use a couple of radio telescopes to examine sun-like stars, stars like our own sun, which constitute about 10% of the more than 200 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy, which, by the way, is just one of a great many galaxies. This detailed search will look for signs of artificial signals. What you do is you put a receiver that can examine a huge number of radio frequencies on the radio telescope and a custom-designed computer to discard everything that looks natural. There's a lot of natural radio noise coming in from the nebulae and galaxies, and that's why we have radio telescopes. They're primarily to conduct ordinary science. And so you have to sift through all this looking for the spike of an unnatural signal. The other survey, the All-Sky Survey, is at a lower level of sensitivity, but examines a large area so that if you have a powerful signal coming from further away, it might make it through. The problem with SETI is an embarrassment of riches. The sheer abundance of stars, the very abundance that makes us think there might be life out there in the first place, also means that you have to look at a tremendous number of stars before you would have a reasonable chance of seeing something. Suppose, for instance, that, take an optimistic scenario, there are 10,000 alien civilizations out there all broadcasting beacons our way, and you had a radio telescope that could go from one star to another and examine each one for about an hour and move on. For that search to have a 50-50 chance of hitting one of those stars around which orbited a planet on which there was one such civilization would take something like 50 or 100 years. So SETI is a business where you have to be prepared to go in for the long haul. It's you have to resist the human tendency, the very human tendency, to say, oh, gee, we haven't got any results here. We've been at it for 10 years, so there must be no one out there.
I feel like saying to our listeners, we're talking about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. My guest is not a nut. do you worry about this anymore, that when you start talking about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, that people think, well, he's a kook. We can dismiss what he has to say. Is it still that way?
There is a lot of feeling that way, and there's also on the other side a substantial portion of the public that believes that we've already been visited by flying saucers, so why should we have to discuss it any further? And there are a lot of received attitudes out there. The big difference, it seems to me, between taking a scientific or an empirical view and taking a more fundamentalist view is not whether you believe in, you know, God or extraterrestrial life or any particular hypothesis, but whether you keep an open mind. The great division is between people who are prepared to keep learning and those who have a dogmatic attitude. And sure, you know, any speculative hypothesis, you'll have trouble from people who take a dogmatic attitude. And that doesn't bother me.
Timothy Ferris, your new book, The Mind's Sky, is in part about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, but it's also about the human mind and the mystery surrounding how the human mind works. What's the connection that you see between the search and the human mind?
The question I've been asking myself over the years has been, what do we mean by intelligence when we ask ourselves the question, is there intelligent life elsewhere in the universe? After all, everything we're ever going to know about the universe, whether it has to do with this or other subjects, will be within our own minds. That's the only place in which we can have a conception of the universe. So science and art and other dialogues between ourselves and the wider world are dialogues. They're an interaction between the mind, which somehow has come into existence in this universe. We don't know how or why. So lately I've been trying to learn more about what little we know about the brain. And one of the things you find there is that the brain is a constellation of different intelligences. It's not a monolithic thing. There are perhaps over 100 identifiable brain programs operating. And so we look out on a universe of stars and galaxies, a multiplicity of things. But we also seem to have a kind of galaxy of intelligences inside the skull as well.
One of the chapters in your book that I found particularly interesting was about near-death experiences, and this is part of your search to understand how the human mind operates. And I think a lot of our listeners have probably read accounts of near-death experiences that have described it as being sheathed in light, being very peaceful, being an almost ecstatic experience. What were some of the experiences that you read that got you interested in this subject?
Well, you know, we've had a sort of a series of near-death fads.
Yes, right. Yes, exactly.
It comes and goes, and more people now have, you know, are revived than ever before in, mm-hmm. in operating rooms, typically in emergency wards, after their vital functions have ceased. One of my old childhood friends has twice been clinically dead, and
wow.
He told me that he both times had this experience of passing through the veil of light, and he saw his favorite uncle and everything, who told him to go back. He, by the way, attaches no significance to this. He doesn't think that, you know, he's gone into the afterlife or anything of that sort. And I don't think you can make that claim. The near-death experience clearly doesn't have anything to do with a view of an afterlife. But, and the reason I say that is because people in high-stress situations, there's a fabulous little book called The Experience of Dying in Falls that was published around 1890 or so by a Swiss doctor and alpinist who had a serious fall himself and went around interviewing other climbers who had survived falls, and he found they had the same experience. They pass through the tunnel and they see their relatives and their life passes before their eyes. Well, a healthy 25-year-old climber who's falling 400 feet through the air on a crisp spring day in Jungfrau isn't dead. You know, he's not even ill. He just has every reason to believe that he's about to be dead. So if he has the same experience that people do in these near-death experiences, then the near-death experience is not about death, it's about stress. But it still fascinates me. Why, when you're right at death's door, as they say, should you experience ecstasy? This seems a marvelous question to me. It's an interesting sort of evolutionary question. So I'm trying to call a little attention to that aspect of it.
Why do you see it as an evolutionary question?
Well, I assume that everything, all the fundamental mechanisms of the human nervous system have evolved. Well, they obviously have evolved, but that they have an evolutionary story to tell, you know. Let me give you an example of what I mean. If you are attacked by a bear, as I seriously hope will never happen, a lot of things will suddenly happen to you that make evolutionary sense. You'll get a big dose of adrenaline in the bloodstream. Time will seem to slow down. Muscular strength will increase tremendously for a short period of time. Endorphins released into the bloodstream will cause your pain threshold to be greatly elevated so that you'll feel little or no pain. Well, there's clearly a good evolutionary mechanism for producing all these things, since people who have these experiences are more likely to be able to survive. But I can't imagine what evolutionary value there is in extreme stress, in having your life pass before your eyes, or in seeing your favorite grandmother or something of that sort. So it's a fascinating puzzle to me. I talked to Lewis Thomas about this question many years ago, and he had an idea involving a harmony, that there are harmonies within webs of living systems. At the time, I thought that was primarily a poetic idea, but I've become more interested in what's called information theory, which is a way of looking at the philosophy of science. And I'm beginning to wonder whether harmonies are not, whether harmonies might be, in fact, fundamental to all communication, and communication in turn fundamental to all life. It might be that the reason that we and other species might turn out to be interested in communicating with one another among the stars may be some inchoate, deep-seated reason that has to do with the very nature of life. In other words, life itself may be here for a reason that has to do with communication. And while that sounds like a mystical idea, I only express it because as the years go by, I'm beginning to think that it's not mystical at all, but may turn out to be as fundamental to our understanding of nature as atoms and quarks.
My guest is Timothy Ferris, and he's the author of the new book, The Mind's Sky, Human Intelligence in a Cosmic Context. We're going to take a short break, and we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Timothy Ferris. He writes about astronomy and physics. He's the author of the bestseller Coming of Age in the Milky Way and the new book The Mind's Sky. You know, you're getting back to the question of why are so many near-death experiences almost ecstatic. Some people would think that you are wrong in so easily dismissing the idea that it's not a view into the afterlife.
Mm. Well, I'm not trying to dismiss it. I'm simply saying, as I say in the book, I'm not trying to render a judgment on the whether or not there is such a thing as an afterlife. But I do think it's clear that the near-death experience does not constitute proof of the existence of an afterlife. It's much more likely the opposite is the case, that we formed an impression of heaven as an ethereal realm of light where you meet the dearly departed, because those occasional people who made it through these severe stress situations and came back reported just such a thing. So we can't very well, if indeed our concept of heaven was formed out of reports of near-death experiences, we can't then turn around and say that near-death experiences support the concept of heaven. That's to reason in a circle.
Do you think that it's possible that there are certain enzymes or chemicals that are secreted in the body during these near-death experiences, and that someday scientists will be trying to isolate those chemicals and they'll be the new pleasure drug?
There are these fascinating chemical cascades that go on in stress responses, meaning that one chemical releases dozens more and so forth, and you get tremendously fast results. Brain chemistry is very quick. It's as quick as thought itself. And stress reactions are very fast. Have you ever been in a situation where you You had profound physical changes because of the stress that you were under.
I've had minor versions of that, but I've never been in, you know, I've never been in the attacked by the bear scenario where, or the scenario where you can lift a car to rescue somebody beneath
yeah.
it, you know. So
yeah.
I've never been pushed to that limit.
It's I've just been, you know, close to it similarly, and it's funny the things that happened to you. I remember. I spun, 1964, I spun a Penske Corvette in the rain across two oncoming lanes of 70-mile-an-hour traffic, and I went right through a cluster of cars without touching any of them. And by that time, time had slowed down so much, you know, that I could have read the whole Sunday New York Times before I'd gotten through the cluster of cars. And an image came printing across my field of view, like the Times Square news report, you know, on that sign with the lights that said, read, this is how you get killed. And it was an experience utterly without any emotional content. It was chemically so different. It was much different than I could imagine any drug experience producing from normal life. So I do think that we could imagine an era in which you would take a particular kind of organic pill, or be administered to, particularly to lower your sensitivity to pain.
You know, because a chapter on mysticism in it. What scientifically interests you in mysticism?
Well, probably not much scientifically, but a lot personally. If you read the writings of the great mystical writers like Lao Tzu in China, this is clearly marvelous stuff. And mystical thinkers have enjoyed a great currency even amongst the most hard-headed empirical scientists. Einstein is a good example, who always insisted, as he put it, that the most beautiful experience accessible to us is the mystical experience. And he was a fairly mystical guy himself. So I've tried to explore what might be going on in the mystical experience in terms of the architecture of the brain, and it's only a preliminary reconnoitering of this question, but it's an interesting one. It may turn out in the future that mystical reports are sort of like, you know, frontier Lewis and Clark reports about the inner architecture of the brain, and that in centuries to come, when we understand the brain a lot better, this literature will be looked back upon as those were, you know, and as the explorers' reports were, when you had early preliminary maps and you'd look at them and say, oh, look, they had part of Florida, but they didn't know about Texas, you know, and that sort of thing. I think, in other words, that the mystical experience is not some kind of delusion, as some scientists seem to think, or something that we're going to get past. I think it's something fundamental to the human experience.
You know, there's few things I hate more than when someone comes up to me and says, I'm a left-brain person. What about you? It's really just ruined the whole idea of the split brain for me. So let me ask you to, like, rescue what's interesting about the idea from the people who have just kind of ruined it and turned it into this really silly, what's your sign yeah. type of affair. You write a little bit about the split brain in the new book. Get us thinking about that a little bit.
Here in California, we had an effort to increase right forebrain education, as if, you know, we already had enough education for the left forebrain, which we don't. The only reason that the split brain became part of our popular culture is because there is an operation that makes it possible and, in some cases, desirable to split the brain. You know, we have two lobes in the higher brain, left and right lobe. And they communicate by means of a kind of a high bandwidth communications channel called the corpus callosum. In certain cases of severe epilepsy, patients who have just constant epileptic fits can find relief by a heroic operation in which one goes in and simply cuts the corpus callosum, thus cutting off communication between the two lobes. But a neurophysiologist named Roger Sperry and his colleagues in California some years ago began conducting experiments with these split-brain patients in which they would restrict information to one lobe so that the other lobe wouldn't know about it. And in this fashion, they found that certain brain functions are localized within one or the other hemisphere. For instance, in most people, certainly most right-handed people, the ability to understand and process language is usually confined, by and large, to the left cerebral hemisphere, the hemisphere that controls the right side of the body. Well, that's interesting, but it's only the beginning. And what we're beginning to find out now is that there's a lot more localization of function in the brain. And a great example of that, I think, is work has been done recently by Michael Gazzaniga, an American brain researcher who worked with Sperry. Gazzaniga found a function in the left hemisphere that he calls the interpreter, the job of which seems to be to act as a kind of PR agent for the conscious mind, and constantly keep reassuring it that it is in control and that it understands everything that you are doing, even though it doesn't. To give you an example, if you hypnotize someone and give them a post-hypnotic suggestion that when you say apple, they're going to crow like a bird, and then you bring them out, you say apple, and they crow like a bird, they will invariably give you a reason why they did this. You know, they'll start crowing, and of course, they'll hear themselves crowing, and they'll say, ah, it's a great day, isn't it? I just feel like letting off some steam. Something like that. The reason Gazzaniga's experiments using split-brain patients indicate is that this interpreter program will constantly provide you with a rationale for what you're doing, even when it has no idea why you're doing this thing, as is the case under hypnosis. It's not getting any information, so it just makes up something. And when I find that very useful in everyday life, you know, we all say things sometimes that just don't, you know, we say, why did I say that? You know, so they're often not even true. You didn't mean to lie exactly. You just found yourself saying it, you know. That's the interpreter in action, one of perhaps 120 programs in the brain that somehow have to all function coherently enough that we think of ourselves as each being one person.
That's really fascinating. But I want to warn our listeners that if I meet any of you in the street, do not introduce yourself as a left or a right brain person. It's really been such a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much for sharing some of your research. And
Terry, always a pleasure to talk with you.
And thanks very much. My guest has been Timothy Ferris. He writes about astronomy and physics. His new book is called The Mind's Sky, Human Intelligence in a Cosmic Context. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.